Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Vox Pop. I'm Alan Shartok, and I have to tell you, I'm delighted that you're all here with us today. Joining us today for Medical Monday is Dr. Gregory Tulu. Dr. Tulu is a general surgeon with Ellis General Surgery. He practices a wide range of surgeries, but also focuses on laparoscopic, robotic surgery, abdominal wall reconstruction, and upper and lower endoscopy. Dr. Tulu earned his medical degree from Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., and completed his residency in general surgery at Albany Medical Center, where he served as chief resident. He is board certified in general surgery and licensed in the state of New York. Dr. Tulu, welcome to Medical Monday.
Thank you very much.
So, you know, it's interesting that people need operations. And back when I was a kid, people used to say, I need an operation.
Well, luckily with laparoscopy and smaller incisions, it's gotten much easier to go through a lot of these things.
You got a machine?
Well, it's small incisions using a laparoscope, a small camera. So yeah. Instead of having a large midline incision that can take weeks or months to heal, we're using incisions that are the size of about a centimeter or so. And much faster, people are healed within weeks and back to full activity.
So what is the toughest operation you regularly have to do?
I would probably say colon resections for colon cancer, although there can be some very difficult abdominal hernias. They tend to be recurrent, especially in people who are obese or smokers and have trouble healing. So going back into an area that's been operated on multiple times is never easy, and we do see that quite often. So.
There's been a lot of talk about the meshes that are used to repair hernias, and I think they even have ads on in the middle of the night to say if you had a...
Well, most of those meshes are actually used in pelvic surgeries for people who have weakened pelvic floors and will have some prolapse of their pelvic organs, and mostly in women. So those meshes have become
problematic. Oh, those are the bad ones, you mean?
Yes.
But otherwise...
The ventral hernia meshes, the inguinal hernia meshes are not perfect by far, but certainly don't cause the types of problems that the meshes that are used in the pelvis for those types of operations have.
What does inguinal mean?
Inguinal just means in the groin.
Oh, I see.
So okay. Very common in men due to the formation of the testicles during development. The path that they take from inside the abdomen to the normal anatomy can leave some weaknesses in the abdominal wall. So that's typically why we see that happen more often in men than women, but it can happen in anyone.
So you're saying the problem is always at the beginning of life, really?
It can start there, yes. Or it can be in people who, perform heavy lifting quite often in their jobs, so we see it often in construction workers, weightlifters, and athletes. They can be more of a developed hernia. Unfortunately, it's just kind of a natural flaw in the way that the musculature is designed, and there's a natural area of weakness.
Let's go back to colon for a minute.
Sure.
So when you resection, meaning you cut out a piece, right? Mm-hmm. And then do people always have to wear a bag as a result of that?
Not necessarily. And actually, the data of late, a lot of it coming out of wartime data, shows that it's safer to try to reconnect the bowel even when it has been prepped for a surgery.
I don't think I understand what that means.
So normally when we would do an elective surgery for, let's say, somebody has a known colon cancer, we want to take that out.
Sure.
If we can prep the bowel, meaning clean it out of all of the stool that it contains, it's a cleaner field. When you're reconnecting things, you don't have stool flowing through a new anastomosis or a new connection that may be weak to begin with. So for many years, we gave people these preps and antibiotics and all kinds of things to help minimize the risk of that new connection or anastomosis leaking. So now some of the data coming from especially trauma and wartime surgeries shows that it is a bit safer to not have to do that prep before a surgery. Or if it's in an emergency, somebody comes in with a perforation, say from diverticulitis, you could potentially put the bowel back together rather than having to create a bag or an ostomy.
Now, do you do diverticulitis also?
I do. Yes.
So tell us what that is again.
Well, diverticulitis, let's start with, I guess, diverticulosis. Diverticulosis is very common disease. By the time we reach the age of about 70, probably 60 to 70% of the population will have some degree of diverticulosis.
Right.
Which is just the creation of small pouches in the wall of the colon.
This comes from our meat eating?
Yes, it does. It's from eating a poor or low fiber diet.
Right.
So very common in the Western world. That can develop diverticulitis or an inflammation of those pouches, typically from a small perforation or back pressure in the pouches. It becomes clogged with stool or other material.
And how do we treat that?
It depends. It kind of runs on a scale or a spectrum of severity. Mild disease can be just some inflammation and can be treated as an outpatient with antibiotics.
Yeah. But so antibiotics, I had a cousin who had, his wife was always giving him a glass of milk. That turned out not to be right, didn't it? No, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the milk was for something else.
Probably not for diverticulitis,
I don't think.
Although, again, we talk about now probiotics and the bacteria that lives in the bowel and how that affects things as well. But it can be as simple as an antibiotic course for a week or two. If the bowel is perforated from a severe case, it may mean emergency surgery, in which case an ostomy may need to be created simply because it's such a hostile environment. And if you tried to reconnect the bowel and keep it in line, it may not heal properly.
Now, I'm a little stupid, and I apologize.
That's all right.
But you're not supposed to say that.
Well, that's why I'm here. I'm here to educate.
Can't you have diverticulitis in the stomach area, too?
A diverticulum is simply an abnormal pouch, usually the full thickness of whatever organ you're talking about.
Right.
So you can see them in the esophagus.
Right.
There can be traction diverticulum. You can see them in the small intestine. There's something called a Meckel's diverticulum, which is more, again, of a congenital problem. So it depends on where you're talking about it. Most often when you talk about diverticulitis, you're referring to the colon.
And what is the worst cancer that you have to see on a regular basis?
Again, that can vary. I've seen some very, very advanced cases of breast cancer.
Yeah.
Probably the worst cancer that I saw was a gentleman with colon cancer that had metastasized.
Okay.
Unfortunately, he was not having many symptoms and presented at a very late stage. And so it was very difficult to treat.
So what's the best way to deal with that?
Often we still do attempt to chemotherapy.
No, but I'm talking about not you getting...
As a surgeon?
No, I'm talking about as a potential patient.
Oh.
How do we avoid these hard-to-find cancers?
Well, if I had the answer to that, I'd probably have a Nobel Prize in medicine, unfortunately. And the problem is a lot of these cancers, you don't develop symptoms until they have invaded other structures or until they're at far advanced stages.
Yeah. So every once in a while you hear somebody says, okay, I went and I got a total body scan. Doctors don't like that because they say you find too many false negatives or positives or stuff.
Not always sure how to, evaluate that data.
Right. But on the other hand, if you do it and you catch a major one,
Well, there's a bit of serendipity in that. And I think certainly that happens. People will come in with one complaint and get a scan or an X-ray, and we find something unexpected. And sometimes that means we catch it early. Other times, yes, it is at an advanced stage, and our hands are tied a little bit.
Okay.
But that's the importance of screening tests as well.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, your turn. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to our first call from Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Do you find you get as good cosmetic result using staples as opposed to, say, like a figure eight mattress suture?
I'm assuming you're talking about when we're closing the skin on an incision.
Right.
And really, there's not much of a difference between a staple closure and a suture closure. It all depends a lot of times on the timing of removing the staples or removing any external sutures. Quite often now we're using sutures that are absorbable. But overall, I'd say depending on timing and other factors involved in healing, the cosmetic results are fairly equivalent.
So what do you mean, how do you decide when to take the staples out?
Well, one, it depends on how well the wound is healed.
I see.
If it seems like the tissues are still weak or there's infection or things like that, you may want to leave them in a bit longer. Obviously, if you leave them in too long, the skin can start to overgrow the staples or the suture. And I've certainly seen people that have reacted to just having the suture present. It is a foreign body technically, so often the tissue will overreact and cause an inflammatory response.
You don't want that.
We don't want that either. We've seen people years later that will develop what's called a suture granuloma or abscess, where there's material that's deep in the tissues. It's a permanent material, and their body constantly attacks it. So they develop an abscess or a a response to that, and often we have to go back in and remove that suture. Luckily, things have healed by then, so the suture's not doing much. But
1-800-348-2551. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be right back. There are three free phones. I want you to be on one of them. It may save your life.
Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new gastroenterology center in Johnstown, New York, accepting new patients, nlh.org. Capital Cities Imported Cars, Glenmont, New York, offering new and pre-owned BMWs and Volkswagens, serving the WAMC listening area since 1975, capitalcitiesvw.com. The Linda, WAMC's performing arts studio, presenting Food for Thought, Bag It, Thursday at 7 p.m., thelinda.org. Baba Louie's, Pittsfield, Great Barrington, and Hudson, New York, featuring lasagna night every Monday with salad and a basket of bread, babalouiespizza.com. And from The Blue Marble, a world of gifts in Amherst, Massachusetts, featuring hand-selected jewelry from over 40 artists, including local, Native American, and fairly traded work, thebluemarble.biz.
And we are back. And it is a great pleasure to have Dr. Tilou, a board-certified surgeon with Ellis General Surgery Practice in Schenectady. You have partners?
I do. I'm working with Dr. Mark Sanchez and Dr. Satish Muthubarapu.
Now, what happens when you do you ever have an operation which you just know going in you're going to need two guys as opposed to one?
It does happen, yes, and it's certainly in any case it can be having a second set of skilled hands can certainly make things go faster.
Right.
And sometimes just having a fresh set of eyes come in. So if I'm struggling with a surgery, not necessarily sure how to make it go a little more smoothly, having somebody come in and just look at things a little differently can sometimes make it a big difference.
What's the most operations you've ever done in one day?
I would say probably up to a dozen, depending on that.
Really?
That was some elective surgeries.
Wow.
We'll schedule four or five a day, depending on the duration that they may take. And then certainly on call, we can get all manner of problems coming in emergently.
Sure.
So
emergently.
I've certainly operated over 24 or 30 hours before.
Oh, boy. Let's go to Matt in Rosendale. Hiya, Matt. How you doing?
Good. Thanks a lot for having the show,
sure.
Alan and Doc. I have a question about something I was told long ago. I had a resection due to diverticulum having, I think they said it burst.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the bottom line is I was told then not to eat seeds and nuts. A couple of years later, I went to another doctor, and he told me that's not the case. He had done many, many operations and never saw a seed or a nut in a diverticulum. Then I went back to my regular doctor, and he told me, look, you haven't eaten seeds and nuts for 10 years. Don't start now. What do you say?
Well, it's an issue that comes up all the time with people who have diverticulitis. The teaching is somewhat archaic. There's never been a study that's shown a direct cause and effect relationship between eating that type of food and causing diverticulitis. However, if you think about it, it somewhat makes some logical sense. Seeds and nuts are not digested by the GI tract well, so they leave small particle matter that could potentially obstruct these small pouches. However, I've had lots of people that have eaten seeds and nuts and have had no problem with their diverticulitis. I've had others that say even if they look at a peanut, they start to feel some discomfort.
It's those little things. You get mixed nuts and then peanuts. Those are big already, and cashews. But then you get those little things in there.
You're breaking down into small particles as you chew. And again, you don't have the enzymes in the GI tract to further dissolve or digest those that matter.
Yeah. So tell Matt what to do.
Well, it's kind of the old joke, Doc, it hurts when I do that. Well, don't do that. So if you have trouble eating seeds and nuts, you probably should avoid them.
Yeah, but he doesn't know that.
Well, you could try. Again, it's probably not likely to...
No, I don't want to go through that again.
Well, I understand. It was probably a very bad situation. But again, the likelihood of it causing a problem is incredibly low. It's one of those things where you just don't know. And some people do complain of issues after eating seeds and nuts. But there's no strong link between one causing the other.
Okay, last question on this. If you have to operate on a diverticulitis situation, mm-hmm. What would the operation look like? What would you do?
Well, typically, it depends on when you're doing the operation. If you're doing it emergently,
yes.
You're probably going to have an open procedure because yes. there's severe inflammation, potentially an abscess.
Yeah.
You're likely going to resect the portion of the colon that's... remove it completely.
Yeah.
And that could be anywhere from a few inches to even a foot or more of
bowel. So you can't just cut that little thing out?
Not necessarily. You have to really remove it to where there's healthy tissue. One, to try to put it back together if the environment is safe for that. Or you, in an emergency situation like that, you're likely going to create an ostomy. And then after anywhere from probably 3 to 6 months, depending on the severity.
In other words, you're wearing a bag.
You go back and you then reconnect the bowel and you can take the ostomy down. So they're very often temporary.
How do they do that with you, Matt?
I did not have a bet, but I did have to stay in the hospital for weeks on antibiotics mm-hmm. in order for the colon to get rid of some of its infection. And then they reconnected me. But I didn't know till I woke up whether there would be a bag or not.
Yeah.
And often it can be a 2 or 3 stage procedure to get you to the point where things are connected back in line over the course of months.
Matt, we always love hearing from you. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Alan.
Right.
Bye.
Bye. Let's go to Chrissy in Niskayuna. Okay, Chrissy, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling because I gave birth to my daughter about 2 months ago.
Congratulations.
And when I was at my, thank you. When I was at my 6 week post appointment, the doctor told me that I have something called an umbilical hernia, mm-hmm. I think.
A very common hernia.
I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what that is, if I had done something to cause it while I was pregnant, and what my options are for treating it.
Sure. They're very common, especially after childbirth, because of the strain placed on the abdominal wall. The umbilicus, as you know, is where the umbilical cord entered the abdomen while you were in the womb and what mm-hmm. nourished you as a fetus. Obviously, after birth, that we cut the cord, the rest of the cord dissolves and falls away. But it can leave an area that's naturally weak because it did at one point enter the abdominal cavity. Very common to see that happen either from birth or develop later on in life as the weakness turns then into an actual hole. And that's what a hernia anywhere is an unnatural hole in a structure, often in the abdominal wall. And what can come through that hole is either some fat from inside the abdomen, or where they're dangerous is that intestine or other important organs can come through that hole and potentially get caught in the hole.
And where does the belly button come into this?
Well, again, the belly button is the center of the abdomen because of the umbilical cord. It's just a natural weak area that tends to develop these defects.
Okay.
The simplest way to handle these things is, after the abdominal wall, especially after pregnancy, has kind of come back down and regained some of its strength, is to repair them surgically. That typically is done through an open procedure because it's a small defect and a small incision. Laparoscopy is an option, but in most of these cases, it's a very tiny defect that can easily be repaired with one incision rather than 2 or 3 necessary or 4 necessary to do it laparoscopically. So I tend to repair these with an open repair. Often we'll use mesh, but if the defect is very small, a suture repair is adequate by just sewing it closed.
So Chrissy, anything else on this?
Would that require me being out of work for a long period of time? Like, is that something I should do during a summertime month?
It depends on what you do for work. If you do a job that involves heavy lifting, you're most likely not going to be able to do that type of activity for about 4 weeks after the procedure, 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
If you work at a desk, you could be back to work within a few days to a week.
What do you do?
I teach.
Yeah, so the summers are good.
Always a good time to do
exactly.
it in the summer.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Thanks, Chrissy.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Okay, there's one free phone now, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Cindy in Queensbury. Okay, Cindy, you're on.
Hello. I'm calling about, I had a hysterectomy laparoscopically. I'm an old lady. I'm 63.
That ain't old.
well, at the moment, it feels old. What I'm trying to discover is I had wonderful plans. I used to use my rowing machine 3 times a week. I hiked. I did all kinds of things, which I've been told now I can't do anymore. And I'm not happy about that. Is there any kind of surgical procedure that would strengthen the muscles that hold my bladder in place so that I could go back to the things I really loved and enjoyed before this surgery? And it was a year ago, by the way.
Okay. From a laparoscopic standpoint, I'm not sure, again, the whole situation, but often it can take several weeks before you can perform those activities, but I don't know that I would tell anybody they'll never do it again. Now, if you have some pelvic floor weakness, that's a different situation. Unfortunately, we're getting outside the area of my expertise, and that's something that the OBGYNs or there are urogynecologists that will perform certain procedures to help strengthen the pelvic floor so that the organs aren't prolapsing. So there are some procedures available. They're not anything I have done in the past or do now. So I'm a little cautious to comment.
I had a total hysterectomy. I had a total hysterectomy, so and I what just do want to get my life back.
But typically after even a total hysterectomy, most women go back to normal active lives. So, again, I'm not sure what in this case is different.
Yeah, why? Okay, maybe I need a second opinion is what potentially. I may need. Yeah. Yes.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yep. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to Peter in Schenectady. Okay, Peter, you're on.
Yes, hello, doctors. I have you answered my question just previously with another caller. This is about diverticulitis stenosis, but I had a backup question.
Okay.
And that's, I had a diverticulitis attack the first time I had it about 4 years ago, and it's pretty severe, you know, but the medication that I took for like a week got rid of it. A month later, I sort of had a resurgence, so they gave me the medication again. Mm-hmm. And my question was, ever since that bout, my stool has been different than what it used to be. And I'm wondering if that's because maybe I've wiped out a lot of the biome in my gut with the antibiotics that's been replaced by something that I didn't have from birth, sort of a new biome.
It's potentially that. When you say it's different, is it different in consistency or size?
Consistency and color and things. It's just never been the same.
Right.
It's always been this other way now.
Well, diverticulitis, again, is an inflammatory process. So sometimes when you've had recurrent bouts, you develop scarring or strictures. This can affect absorption, and so that may be why you're having some difference in consistency. But diverticulitis can be a difficult thing, and it's often hard to tell when should we respond and treat it surgically. You know, that's a conversation that I have with my patients. It could be after one attack. It could be after six or seven attacks, depending on when they occur. But there can be some changes in the type. And that's why we also, after anybody's had an attack of diverticulitis, we tend to recommend a colonoscopy to look at the bowel, make sure that there's not something hiding. Could it be that it wasn't diverticulitis, but an occult malignancy or tumor or polyps or something else? So it's very important after you've had an attack to then after the inflammation is settled, to have a colonoscopy to reevaluate things.
Yes, and I just had one last month again after my 3 years after the initial colonoscopy after the attack. So things are okay there, but I was just curious about the biome thing because there's a lot of talk about the bacteria in the gut these days.
Sure,
that's true.
Okay, Peter, thank you for the call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank
you. All right. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to Mark in Albany. Okay, Mark, you're on.
Thank you for everything, Alan. Doctor, I had diverticulosis for many years. Became itis 5 years ago, ruptured, and they took out my sigmoid colon.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor told me that reconnecting would put me out of commission for 2 to 4 weeks, and I've never found that length of time until I just retired. So I'm planning to reconnect it in July, which is when there's less pollen in the air and I'm least likely to sneeze violently. What are the concerns about that procedure? What are the possible bad outcomes? What are the odds of them? Having the bag is a big, big nuisance.
True. The surgery, it is a major operation, and so part of what affects that is your general health. So if you're thinking about undergoing a procedure like that, you'll most likely need to see whether it's your primary care doctor or cardiologist to ensure that you're healthy enough to undergo that procedure. Typically, the reversal is easier than the initial operation, although with that type of inflammation in the abdomen, it can be somewhat difficult to free up the anatomy and do that. One of the more serious risks, but not a very common problem, is when you reconnect the bowel, it could potentially leak. In which case, it may require another surgery to repair that leak. We could have to create a different type of ostomy to prevent stool from going through the new connection and allow it to heal. That's called a diverting, usually an ileostomy. But certainly there's a risk with any general surgery, such as heart attack, stroke, reactions to anesthesia, bleeding, infection. But all of these risks are very low, and obviously these are the things we don't want to see happen. So we're very careful to avoid them.
So if this stuff leaks...
Can you give me a percentage number on those risks?
Most of them are below 1%.
How about below a tenth of 1%?
Some of them could be. It depends on which complication you're talking about. And again, it also depends...
Mostly mortality.
Mortality is well below probably a tenth of a percent. It's very unlikely, unless, again, you have underlying cardiac, pulmonary,
but if that stuff gets, but if that stuff gets into your open area, if it leaks, that could be terrible, right?
It can be, and often we have to go back and
reoperate. What is that called?
It's called an anastomotic leak. So yeah. The anastomosis is the new connection. If the staple line or where we've sutured it, depending on the technique used, is not adequate, stool can be leaking into your abdomen, and that can make you incredibly sick. Sometimes we'll leave drains in the abdomen to identify if that's occurring and hopefully catch it sooner. It doesn't necessarily prevent the problem, but we can identify it a little bit sooner. But it is a major complication of these surgeries. Luckily, as I said, it's a very low occurrence.
Hey, Mark in Albany, thank you for your call. Appreciate it.
One last question.
It's got to be fast. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mark.
Does the 5-year lag, does that create any additional issues?
Not likely, unless you, in the last 5 years, have had some other major medical problem develop, like hypertension, or have had a heart attack or other major issue. But in terms of the surgery, probably not much of a difference.
Thank you, Mark. Okay. All right, let's go to Lindsay. Okay, Lindsay, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you?
We're good. How are you?
Good. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm good. Thank you so much for the show. I'm calling. I had my gallbladder removed in 2007. And since 2007, I've actually had more what I would call similar to my gallbladder attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Very painful, diarrhea, vomiting, I'd say maybe 5 to 6 times a year or more. I'd go to the hospital at times when the pain's so bad, and the only thing that they're ultimately able to find is my liver enzymes are very, very elevated. So I've seen some gastroenterologists, and just recently someone told me that I may have what's called sphincter of Oddie or
ODI
dysfunction.
Yes.
ODI. And so he's recommended surgery, but talked about the risks of that, given with me, pancreatitis, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I opted not for the surgery, and I'm just wondering if there's something else that may help these, my diet or enzymes or something that may help with these symptoms that'll just come. And sometimes they're actually associated, believe it or not, with my menstrual cycle. I think right around my menstrual cycle, it gets so bad and the symptoms are really bad. So I was just wondering your thought on that.
Here we go. Doctor.
Well, often that does happen after gallbladder surgery. About 1% of people who have had their gallbladder removed will have what's called post-cholecystectomy syndrome. And that's simply because you've now removed an organ that does have some function and purpose. And so the bile.
What do you do, Doc, when you have a gallbladder removed? How do you replace the function?
Well, oftentimes it's a transient problem, and it just takes your body some time to adjust to the gallbladder no longer being there.
Right.
There are some medications that can help because part of the problem is that you have bile in the GI tract that normally wouldn't be there. It would be contained in the gallbladder. Or there's not enough bile to help digest, so you get bloating and gassiness and mucousy stools and diarrhea and things like that, often right after eating. So there are some medications called bile acid salts, binders, that like cholestyramine, which will kind of bind that and keep it out of the GI system and help with that. But unfortunately, they're not the best tasting things and are sometimes not the best tolerated. A lot of times it's not simply that the gallbladder was the only issue. Even though we know that the gallbladder had a problem, whether it was his function or stones, there's often other GI problems that go hand in hand with that, like acid reflux. Celiac disease is a very common disease now with, you know, gluten allergies and things like that that can cause these symptoms. And that's the problem with the GI tract is there's 100 things that can cause the same symptoms, so it's hard to identify.
What does the gallbladder do?
The gallbladder is mainly just a reservoir, a storage reservoir for bile. And it also concentrates that bile. So when you do eat a fatty meal, that reservoir is there to mix with the food and break down fat. And that's the purpose of bile.
Does somebody like Lindsay, should she not eat fat?
Probably a low-fat diet may help,
okay.
But it's not often just the content of the diet. We talk a lot about the gut biome. There's more and more research being done on that, and often probiotics do help these situations. In terms of sphincter of Oddi dysfunction, which you mentioned, there's more thinking that that could be the underlying issues. The sphincter of Oddi is a small muscle sphincter at the base of the common bile duct and pancreatic duct that closes when you don't want those enzymes in the GI tract. When you have a meal, it opens and the enzymes in the bile from the liver mix with the food content and start to digest. Sphincter of Oddi spasm or dysfunction can often mimic those types of symptoms that you would have with gallbladder or pancreatitis because of its location. And I have seen a few patients that we've sent to the GI doctors, and they've been willing to take the chance at doing what's called a sphincterotomy through an endoscopy. So not really an open surgery, but they put a long scope down into the stomach, into the duodenum, where the sphincter of Oddi is. That's where the ducts empty. And they will cut that muscle and allow it to drain. And often that has helped people.
Yeah, I must say, I've been doing this for a long time. I never heard of that before. Hey, Lindsay, we've got to let you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Right. You're welcome.
Well, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back for Nancy and Dennis and Josh and Janet.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive cardiac, neurology, oncology, and emergency care services. Reinventing healthcare one patient at a time, ellismedicine.org. The Ashokan Center, presenting UKFest in concert with Joel Eckhouse, Heidi Swedberg, Marcy Markser, Ruth Unger, Paul Hemmings, and Gerald Ross, Saturday at 8 p.m., ashokancenter.org. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Gray Barrington, for peony, clematis, iris, coleus, lilac, viburnum, vegetables, and the tools to help them grow, wardsnursery.com. Barn Stars Antiques at Rhinebeck, a Memorial Day weekend tradition now under new management. 2 days, 120 new and returning exhibitors, Saturday and Sunday, May 23rd and 24th, barnstar.com. And from New York Folklore Society, announcing Adirondack Attic, a musical history tour with Dan Berggren and Andy Flynn, sharing folk songs and images from the Adirondacks, Friday at 7:30 p.m. in Schenectady, nyfolklore.org for tickets.
And we are back, thanks to our wonderful Zachary, who has connected us. There are two free phones right now, and you can be on one. 1-800-348-1 one free phone right now. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, let's go to Nancy in Wilton. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for having this program. Colon cancer runs in my family. I had a 34-year-old niece who died last year from colon cancer, and then several other relatives in the past. I had a colonoscopy last year, and they found what my gastroenterologist called large precancerous tumors lining the ascending colon. So they took the ascending colon out, and they resectioned it. What he said then is, I don't need to see you for 3 years. What my surgeon said was, you need to be seen in a year. What's your take on that?
I would probably, as the surgeon, want to see you again in a year. Simply because we want to make sure that the new connection that they've created between the bowel after they've resected it, we want to make sure that that's open and working, that there's no sign of residual disease. There are some guidelines to kind of help us figure out when we should do repeat colonoscopies, especially for these issues. I think with a strong family history like that, having had precancerous lesions that were resected, I would probably feel more comfortable seeing you in a year, especially since you just had surgery. Now, the gastroenterologist is looking at this from a slightly different point of view. He's looking at it purely from the fact that you had polyps, and typically the recommendations are a repeat colonoscopy for screening purposes within 3 years, based on the type and number and location of those polyps. And those guidelines are from the American Cancer Society, the American Gastrointestinal Society, the American College of Surgeons. They all can vary a little bit, but they're mostly in agreement. But again, from a surgical standpoint, you know, there's more to it than just the polyps. So I don't think your surgeon's wrong. I don't think your gastroenterologist is necessarily wrong saying you don't need to see him in 3 years. But again, from my standpoint, I would probably follow up sooner.
Oh, so the key question for Nancy is, since the gastroenterologist isn't wrong and the surgeon isn't wrong, can the surgeon who wants to see her in a year find what the gastroenterologist would have found on his or her?
Well, potentially. I mean, again, I think depending on the type of polyp, something growing within a year is certainly possible.
Well, will the surgeon use the same instruments to look down into
They'll do the same, basically the same procedure, involving prepping the bowel, cleaning it out so you can see everything.
That's
the worst part of colonoscopies, too, is that you can't always catch everything. Small lesions could potentially be missed. And as I said, you have issues from the surgical side of things. You have a fresh anastomosis that if it scars down too much or you're having problems moving your bowels, that's something that could potentially be dilated and avoid a problem or stretched.
You raise an interesting point. I've often wondered about this. If you do colonoscopy, obviously anything that's inside the gut, you're going to see, right?
Correct.
But what about outside the gut? In other words, what about on the other side
Well, with
the colon?
Colonoscopy, you wouldn't see anything.
You wouldn't.
You would need another diagnostic test such as a CAT scan, ultrasound, something that looks at the general abdominal cavity.
Interesting, interesting. Nancy, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
All right, bye.
Okay, let's go to Dennis in Latham. Dennis, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask the doctor what he thinks about using medical marijuana to alleviate some of the symptoms of diverticulitis.
I think, again, medical marijuana can be helpful in any type of chronic pain, and certainly that can occur with diverticulitis. Obviously, since it's not quite legal in New York yet, it wouldn't be something I could recommend, but...
I was going to say there's some guys with handcuffs standing outside.
Do you know, could you tell me, would it be your primary care physician or a specialist that would, once it does become legal, who would then prescribe it for a patient?
I think right now we have to ask Governor Cuomo that. I don't think that's been decided. I know they're talking about only a few centers across the state where that would be a possibility. How that is determined and who gets access.
Dispensed. In other words, they don't want to give you the leaves. They want to give you some extract right now. I think think that's the case. Hey, Dennis, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's go to Janet in Kerhonkson. Okay, Janet, you're on. Janet, I just want you to know this morning I had a call from a lovely man who said, Alan, you're way too quick in the last third of the program. You give everybody the bum's rush and don't do that. So go ahead.
Alan, you do everything right. So hello, everybody, and hello, Doc.
Thank you.
Would you please talk about the latest treatments for hepatitis C?
Well, I'll actually have to apologize on this. This is not something that I typically treat. This is usually treated by the gastroenterologists.
So my
knowledge is limited, but I know there's some newer treatments in terms of using monoclonal antibodies and a lot of the same biologic drugs that are being used for other ailments. But unfortunately, like I said, I don't know too much specifically for hepatitis C, other than if it becomes progressive disease with cirrhosis and some of the surgical interventions that can be done for that. But in terms of medical treatment, I'll have to defer.
We'll have a program on this soon. Okay, Janet?
I apologize.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551. Right now, there are two free phones. No. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Catherine in New Windsor. Okay, Catherine, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is regarding diverticulitis. Now, I feel like I'm too young to have it, but I have it. My question is that if I can reduce it or somehow avoid it by diet, by eating more fiber. Now, I hope that I'm from the new school of, you know, just eating as many greens as possible, but there are greens that are difficult to digest.
Like kale.
Kale is very difficult, number of things.
I don't like kale.
Actually, all greens are difficult to digest. We don't have enzymes in our digestive tract to break down the cellulose in the plant wall, so it becomes very difficult. But that's
because we didn't descend from cows.
True. But certainly diet can help minimize the presence of the diverticuli that can lead to diverticulitis. Unfortunately, there's no age where you are too young to have diverticulosis or diverticulitis.
Can she cure it by
diet? It cannot be cured.
Those
pouches are going to be present forever once they've developed.
Now, there's other issues. For example, if I had a high bacteria count. Now, I've had an issue where it was treated and it was an antibiotic that was just specific to the colon or the intestine. Now, I've been tested for bacteria in my stomach. That's never been an issue. Again, it goes hand in hand with the esophagus type things.
Right. That's something called H. pylori.
It's all under control.
Is a different bacteria that would cause diverticulitis. There are very specific bacteria that live in different areas of the gut and are in different concentrations, and that's why there's a lot of research on the gut biome now. But again, in terms of treating the diverticulitis or preventing it, it's an unpredictable process. It could happen at any point. However, to minimize the formation of those pouches, a high-fiber diet is what we recommend. Typically, during a bout of diverticulitis, we would actually tell people to be on a low-fiber diet simply because the gut is inflamed. Again, you're not digesting the plant matter as well as you could. And a lot of residual material in the colon at that time is probably not a good thing. So.
So when it comes to the nuts and some of the chia seeds that are always recommended with the high fiber, now the chia seeds haven't bothered me per se, but then there are times where...
And we've talked about the seeds and nut issue where there's no data that shows that seeds and nuts will cause diverticulitis, but some people do have issues and probably should avoid it. But in general, it's probably not necessary to avoid seeds and nuts completely.
And when it comes to an oatmeal or anything like that,
Oatmeal's a fine. Haven't recently had an attack, then a high fiber diet is what you want to take, and oatmeal would be a good part of that.
Catherine Dears, I'm so sorry. I know I've been criticized for kicking people off too
soon. I'm thanking you for taking the call.
Okay.
That's great.
Thank you.
Confirmed what I believe. Thank you.
And let's go to Sally in Albany. Sally.
Hi. I have been diagnosed with a large hiatal hernia. And the esophagus shows some diverticulosis. And there's a narrowing of the esophagus at the bottom of going into the stomach.
Right.
I've been referred to a surgeon. And I'm wondering what kind of surgery that would entail and how complicated is it?
It's a fairly... large surgery. A hiatal hernia, for those who don't know, is basically where the esophagus enters the abdominal cavity. It goes through your diaphragm or the muscle that helps us breathe. That space can enlarge over time, and it allows the stomach to actually start to raise into the chest, which can cause problems with breathing, which can cause severe acid reflux, and all kinds of problems. So typically, we would try to address these when they're a bit smaller and easier to handle. If it's a large hernia, what you first have to do is bring the anatomy back to its normal position. So you need to bring the stomach back down.
And you do that by diet, too, right?
Unfortunately, diet doesn't necessarily
affect things. Well, I have one, and I'll tell you one thing. If I can keep at an ideal weight, the hiatal hernia does not cause
the
this
weight
problem.
Is more, again, as diet responds to weight, then yes. If you're obese, these hernias can be worse.
Oh, yeah.
Obesity makes just about everything worse. So, but the anatomy has to be restored. The defect has to be closed or repaired so that can't go back up into the chest. And that can involve just suturing it or stitching it closed. Sometimes we do put mesh there as well to reinforce. And then often, because of the reflux that's involved with that, we'll do a partial wrap or bring part of the stomach around the bottom of the esophagus to restore kind of the mechanical valve that prevents reflux.
Interesting.
It is a complicated surgery. It does work well. There certainly can be complications. And again, a lot of this depends on how severe your symptoms are. Sometimes a hiatal hernia can be treated easily with just antacid medications like proton pump inhibitors such as Nexium and
Protonix. I'm taking those. And I do have some acid reflux, but not all the time. And it does calm down with Zantac.
Small meals, Sally.
That often helps,
too. And keep the weight off.
Well, the weight isn't on. I'm not.
Good.
Well, it's probably at the point where the hernia is so large that there's not much you're going to be able to do to fix it other than surgery.
Now, check with your GI person, Sally, because sometimes this is one of those areas where the GI guys or the surgeons don't always agree.
Okay, well, that's where I'm at. My GI person is recommending.
Well, typically the disagreement is when do you repair these? It's not necessarily, you know, a lot of small hernias that aren't very symptomatic, we let go. And unfortunately, as time goes on, they do get much larger, and they're more difficult to repair. So we're probably better off fixing these things when they are small and identified to make it an easier process. But typically, we do find these when they're very big.
And can that be done laparoscopically?
It can be done laparoscopically. It can be done robotically as well, which is becoming a new procedure and has excellent results. So there are options. Sometimes the hernia is so large and there's so much content in the chest that we have to do a dual approach from the abdomen and from the chest cavity to be able to reduce the contents.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so it can be a major operation.
Good luck, Sally.
I was feeling okay until I
Well, I didn't mean to scare you, but you know, the results are very good a lot of times. Yeah. So don't hesitate simply because it's an undertaking. But talk to your doctors and find out if that's what's right for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And next time, don't call. Because thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Unfortunately, part of my job is often scaring people, but...
I know. I get it. I don't understand what happened here. I just did something, but I'm not sure what. Okay. Marion, okay, in Akard, where everybody drives a foreign car and agrees with each other. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I had a colonoscopy in September, and at the same time, I was wearing a heart monitor. And when I came home, I had a telephone message from the heart surgeon's office to ask me to return the call. And they said that my heart monitor had said that my heart had stopped beating for a few seconds. And when I spoke to my gastroenterologist about it, she said that sometimes during the colonoscopy it happens for a few seconds, and they watch the monitor, the anesthesiologist watches the monitor, and it's nothing to be concerned about. And I was just wondering what the medical doctor thought about this.
Well, unfortunately, these arrhythmias and heart problems can be brought to light by anesthetics and procedures. Often the heart will slow down while we're doing a colonoscopy because we're putting you on medications that sedate you and slow down the heart rate and the blood pressure. But also there's a response that the body normally has from the nerves and the connections that will also slow down the heart rate. However, I don't think that I would just ignore this simply because there could be some underlying heart disease. You may need a pacemaker. You could have AV block or something like that could be more serious.
I do have arrhythmia.
Okay. So then in that case, I would certainly follow the cardiologist's advice and have that evaluated further.
Okay,
but often these things come out when we put people under anesthesia and do other procedures.
I know I get criticized for this, Marion, but I got to try to get a few more people in. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, we have a call from Cheryl. We're not going to be able to take it, but she wants to know about Barrett's esophagus. We know what a Barrett's esophagus is, which is a burning of a hole in the esophagus.
Well, it's actually a change in the lining of the esophagus due to acid reflux. So the cells change to a more... consistency like in the intestines.
Yeah.
And that can be precancerous. So
yes,
it is a serious thing to be observed and watched.
First Barrett's, then dysplasia, then cancer.
Correct.
Right? Okay. All right. Thank you for that. You can take that away. Let's go to Susan in Poughkeepsie. Susan, it's got to be real fast because otherwise we're not going to make it. Go ahead.
I just got a colonoscopy and I have Crohn's colitis for 25 years and the transverse colon was highly inflamed. Even though I have no bleeding, my bowel movements are fine and everything.
Susan, I'm sorry for being rude, but you got to give me the question because we're almost out of time.
So he's recommending get on Remicade and have this infusion treatment where I have to go for 2 hours every couple weeks.
Right.
And,
these are the newer drugs, the biologic drugs that are used, the monoclonal antibody drugs that I mentioned, they are very effective. They can be somewhat difficult to tolerate and have side effects. But often, if that's what's necessary, they can be very helpful in controlling Crohn's and ulcerative colitis.
Okay, Susan, that's got to be it. I thank you for your call. We had to leave one person on the line, and that's Pete from Grahamsville, where everybody eats crackers, and he's got chronic back pain, and we'll do that on another show. I promise you, Pete, we will. Okay, we're out of time. My apologies to Pete. I want to thank Dr. Gregory Tallou for joining us today. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz. He's terrific. For answering the phones, our producers, Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wmc.org/voxpop. If you love this program, folks, and if you value this radio station, This is Alan speaking. Now is the time. You've got to go to WAMC.org and put something in the lockbox. Never told you how much, but if everybody would do something right now, we would make tremendous strides. We made 115,000. We need 375. It can be certainly done, but it needs everybody to go to the lockbox now. So be there with us again. Thank you all for participating, listening, and calling.